A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
I was standing at the graveside yesterday, watching the funeral directors work. Two of them, maybe mid-30s, in dark suits, handling the casket with this quiet, practiced choreography, lowering it into the ground while the family stood there in that strange, suspended silence you get at burials. And I found myself staring at them, not at the ceremony, thinking, you do this every day. You go home, you make dinner, you watch something on Netflix, and tomorrow you come back and do it again. What does that do to a person? Daniel was at the same funeral, his first in the US actually, and he sent us a whole raft of questions about it. Who becomes a funeral director? How do they get comfortable with death in a way most people never do? Do they believe in the afterlife, in ghosts, in anything paranormal? Or does the job squeeze that out of them? How much do they actually know about the burial rituals of different religions? Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, the whole spectrum. And the one that stuck with me. How do you go from a graveside at 4 in the afternoon to grabbing a drink with friends at 6 without that feeling jarring?
So we started digging into who actually becomes a funeral director, and the answer isn't what most people assume.
It almost never is.
The public imagination has this very specific picture. The gaunt man in the black suit lives alone, probably keeps a raven, reads Poe by candlelight.
Morticia Adams with a business license.
Right. And the reality is, most funeral directors are business people who grew up in the family trade. The NFDA, the National Funeral Directors Association, puts the number at roughly 70% of funeral homes being family owned. Multi-generational. Grandpa started it, Dad took over, now the kids are running it. You don't choose funeral directing so much as you absorb it. You're 12 years old and your summer job is washing the hearses.
That's a very different entry point than I felt a calling to serve the dead.
And yet the calling narrative is real for the other 30%. There are people who enter the profession because they had a formative experience. A funeral director who handled their parents' service with extraordinary care, and they thought, I want to do that for someone else. Or they're drawn to the blend of practical skill and emotional caregiving. It's a service profession, fundamentally.
So the who is either someone who was born into it or someone who had a moment where they realized this work matters. Neither of those is morbid.
And the demographics bear that out. There are roughly 15,000 funeral homes in the US. The average funeral director is in their 40s or 50s, not young. Daniel's observation about younger staff at this particular funeral might reflect a specific region, or a newer generation entering the field. The profession as of last year was about 60% male, 40% female, and that female percentage has been rising steadily for 2 decades. Mortuary science programs now have majority female enrollment in a lot of places.
So the face of the profession is shifting even as the ownership structure stays stubbornly family-based.
Right. And the training pipeline is more rigorous than most people realize. Most states require an associate's or bachelor's degree in mortuary science. These are programs accredited by the American Board of Funeral Service Education. Then a 1 to 2 year apprenticeship under a licensed director, then a national board exam, then a state license. The curriculum is, look, I pulled up the course list for the University of Minnesota's Mortuary Science program. You've got embalming, restorative art, thanatochemistry.
Thanatochemistry. That's a real word.
The chemistry of death. Tissue decomposition, preservation chemistry, the whole thing. But alongside that, same program, psychology of grief, counseling, business law, accounting, ethics. They're training you to run a small business and be a grief counselor and handle the technical preparation of remains all at once.
So the answer to how do they get comfortable with death starts in the classroom, not in the mortuary.
It does, but the classroom only builds the scaffold. The real mechanism, and there's actually decent research on this, is a combination of compartmentalization and ritualization. Funeral directors don't become numb to death. They build a professional frame around it, Every step of the preparation process is proceduralized. The body becomes the decedent. The coffin becomes the casket. Decomposition becomes normal tissue changes.
Language as emotional distance.
And it's a learned skill, not a personality trait. The students who enter mortuary science programs aren't already comfortable with death. They develop the comfort through training and exposure. It's like, I remember in medical school, the first time you walk into an anatomy lab with cadavers, there's this visceral reaction. By week 6, you're eating a sandwich during a dissection break. Not because you've stopped respecting the dead, but because your brain has recategorized the experience from existential event to technical procedure.
The sandwich detail is going to haunt me.
The point is, the distancing is functional. It lets you do the work. And funeral directors layer on something else that doctors don't always have, ritual. The step-by-step nature of preparation, the precise choreography of a funeral service, the way you fold the hands, the way you drape the fabric. Ritual is a container for emotion. It gives you something to do with your hands and your attention while the existential weight of what you're handling sits in the next room.
So the comfort isn't comfort. It's a structured way of not falling apart.
That's exactly what it is. And the dark humor, the gallows humor everyone associates with death care workers, is part of the same system. There was a study published in Mortality, the academic journal, in 2022, looking specifically at humor as a coping mechanism among funeral directors. The finding was that it's not disrespect, it's a pressure valve. You make jokes about things you can't otherwise process, in a space where everyone else in the room understands why you're making them. It's the same phenomenon you see in emergency rooms and combat units.
I'm imagining the break room banter and, yeah, I can see why they'd need it.
And here's the thing that surprised me when I was reading up on this. The dead bodies aren't the hard part. Every funeral director I've ever spoken to or read about says the same thing. The bodies are fine. The bodies are the easy part. The hard part is the grieving families.
That actually makes complete sense the moment you say it. The body doesn't argue with you about the casket price.
The body doesn't have a sister who's furious about the flower arrangement. The body doesn't have a son who's been estranged for 10 years and is now drinking in the parking lot. The emotional labor of managing grief, of being the calm professional presence in a room full of people having the worst day of their lives, that's what burns people out. The NFDA estimates burnout rates around 20-25%, and a lot of directors leave the profession within 10 years. Not because of the death, because of the living.
So we've got someone who's trained to handle the technical side of death, who's built these elaborate psychological defenses, and who's probably from a family that's been doing this for generations. But what about the cultural side? Daniel's question about religious training. How much does a funeral director actually know about the burial rituals of, say, Judaism versus Hinduism versus Islam?
This is where the job gets genuinely impressive. A funeral director in a diverse urban area might handle a Catholic funeral mass on Monday, a Jewish burial on Tuesday, a Hindu cremation on Wednesday, and a Muslim janazah on Thursday. Each of those has completely different requirements, different timelines, different relationships with the body.
And they're expected to navigate all of them without offending anyone.
Most states don't mandate specific religious training in the licensing process, but the NFDA and state associations offer extensive continuing education on religious and cultural competency. And in practice, funeral directors become what I call ritual chameleons. They learn the traditions of the communities they serve, often by building relationships with clergy and community leaders.
Take Judaism, since that's what Daniel mentioned. What does a funeral director need to know that's different from a standard Christian burial?
Jewish burial traditions are particularly exacting, and they're also traditions where the funeral director often needs to step back rather than step in. The body is washed and dressed by the Chevra Kadisha, the sacred burial society, not by the funeral director. Embalming is forbidden unless required by law. Cremation is traditionally prohibited, though that's shifting in some reform communities. The casket must be all wood with no metal, no nails, no hinges, nothing. And burial needs to happen as soon as possible, ideally within 24 hours.
So, if you're a funeral director serving a Jewish community, a big part of your job is knowing when to hand the reins to the Chevra Kadisha and when to handle logistics.
The tahara, the ritual washing, is done by members of the community. The funeral director provides the space, the coordination, the legal paperwork, the transport. But the sacred work is done by the community itself. And that's true across a lot of traditions. Muslim janazah rituals involve washing and shrouding the body, typically done by family or community members of the same gender. Hindu funeral rites are ideally performed by the eldest son. The funeral director is a facilitator, not a performer, in a lot of these contexts.
Which means the skill isn't just knowing the rituals, it's knowing your role in them, when to be present and when to disappear.
And getting that wrong can cause genuine harm. Imagine a well-meaning funeral director who doesn't know that in a traditional Jewish burial, the family places the first shovelfuls of earth themselves and he tries to hurry the process along. Or who doesn't understand why the family is insisting on a wooden casket with no viewing. Their cultural competence isn't optional, it's core to the job.
Let's pivot to the paranormal question, because I think this is where Daniel's curiosity and his own beliefs intersect. Do funeral directors believe in ghosts?
The honest answer is, we don't have great data. There's surprisingly little formal research on this. The most cited thing in the industry is an informal survey the Funeral Service Insider newsletter ran in 2019. It's not scientific, self-selected respondents, small sample, but it suggested funeral directors are slightly less likely than the general public to believe in ghosts or paranormal activity.
Which makes intuitive sense. If you're around death every day, it demystifies.
Possibly, but the same survey also found that a lot of funeral directors report experiences they can't explain. Clocks stopping at the time of death, phones ringing from the deceased's number, a sense of presence in the prep room. The kind of thing that, if it happened to you or me, we'd tell the story at parties for years. For them, it's Tuesday.
And they don't talk about it.
The professional culture discourages it. There's a fear of seeming unprofessional or superstitious. You're supposed to be the calm, rational presence. Admitting you felt something weird in the prep room last night undercuts that. So most of them keep it to themselves, or share it only with colleagues who've had similar experiences.
So the answer to how widespread are paranormal beliefs among funeral directors is less than the general population on paper, but with a whole shadow archive of stories they don't tell.
That's my read, based on what's out there. I'd love to see a proper study. Anonymous, large sample, well-designed. I think you'd find a real gap between what funeral directors say publicly and what they'd admit in a confidential survey.
Which brings us to the last question, and I think the one Daniel was really chewing on at the graveside. How do you go from that, the casket lowering, the family weeping, the earth, to grabbing a drink with friends 2 hours later? How is that not jarring?
I think the premise of the question contains an assumption worth examining. The assumption is that there's a switch, that the funeral director leaves work mode and enters normal life mode, and the transition is difficult. But what the research and the interview suggest is that for most funeral directors, there isn't a switch. There's a professional identity that doesn't require switching.
Say more about that.
If you've spent years building the compartmentalization and ritualization we talked about, if death at work is a technical process with defined steps, and grief at work is a professional service you provide, then leaving work doesn't mean leaving death behind. It means leaving the technical process and the professional service behind. The existential weight was never sitting on your shoulders in the same way it sits on the families.
The jarring feeling Daniel is imagining is more of an outsider projection. We imagine we'd feel jarred, so we assume they must.
I think that's largely right. That said, there's a real phenomenon here that the profession grapples with, and it's not the daily transition, it's the long-term accumulation. Compassion fatigue. Secondary traumatic stress. You spend years absorbing other people's grief, and it doesn't hit you when you're at the bar after work. It hits you 6 years in, when you realize you can't cry at your own father's funeral.
That's grim, but it tracks.
There's actually a documented pattern of delayed grief and complicated mourning among funeral directors. The very skills that make them good at their jobs, compartmentalization, professional distance, the ability to set aside emotion during a service, those same skills make it hard to access their own grief when they need to. The profession has higher than average rates of what psychologists call inhibited grief, grief that gets pushed down and never fully processed.
They're not switching off, they're deferring. And the bill comes due later.
In their own lives, when someone they love dies, That's when the professional frame breaks down and they're just a person who's lost someone with no ritual to hide behind.
All of this is from the outside looking in, though. The research, the studies, the professional frameworks. Hilbert, you actually worked in a funeral home for a summer. What's the view from inside?
The thing nobody tells you is how boring most of it is.
Boring.
You're not standing over bodies contemplating mortality. You're filling out death certificates. 3 copies, and the county clerk rejects the first one because you checked the wrong box. You're on the phone with the cemetery arguing about plot fees. You're trying to find a florist who'll deliver at 6 in the morning because the family changed the service time. My Uncle Mortimer ran a funeral home in a small town in upstate New York for 40 years. I worked for him one summer in high school, drove the flower car, picked up supplies, sat in the back during services in case anyone needed anything.
What kind of town?
Town of about 4,000. Everyone knew everyone. Mortimer had buried most of their parents and a couple of their kids. He used to say the hardest part wasn't the dead people. It was the living ones who wanted to negotiate on the casket price while their mother was in the next room.
That's a very specific image.
Happened more than once. Grief does strange things to people's sense of proportion. They'd fixate on the line item for the hearse mileage because it was something they could control. Mortimer would sit there and let them argue for 20 minutes, because he understood that arguing about mileage was how they were avoiding the thing they couldn't control.
That's not in any mortuary science curriculum.
No. He kept a bottle of whiskey in the prep room. Not for himself, he didn't drink at work. For the families. Sometimes the only thing you can offer a grieving son is a shot of bourbon and a quiet place to sit for 10 minutes. That's not in any textbook either.
The prep room seems like an odd place for that.
It was the only room in the building where nobody would walk in and see him crying. That was the point.
The prep room became a kind of confessional.
I suppose. Mortimer didn't think about it in those terms. He just knew that grieving people need a place where they don't have to perform, and the funeral home is nothing but performance for most families. The prep room was the one honest room in the building.
Did he ever talk about the toll it took on him?
Not directly. He died 6 years ago. Heart attack. I went to the funeral. The new director handled it, some guy who'd bought the business when Mortimer retired. I remember standing there watching the same choreography I'd seen him do 1,000 times and thinking, he'd have had notes. The flower arrangement was off-center.
Did he ever talk about the paranormal side? Ghosts, presences, anything like that?
He said the prep room was never empty. He didn't mean ghosts. He meant the families, the ones who'd sat in that room with the whiskey. He said he could still feel them in there, years later. The weight of all those conversations. He wasn't a superstitious man, but he believed that grief leaves a residue.
Maybe the real story isn't about death at all. It's about the living people who choose to spend their lives in its shadow.
What that shadow does to them over time. The thing I keep coming back to is that funeral directors are mirrors. They reflect our own discomfort with death back at us. We project all kinds of things onto them. Morbidity, weirdness, emotional numbness, because it's easier than sitting with our own feelings about mortality.
Daniel's curiosity at the graveside, staring at those 2 young directors instead of at the ceremony. That's the same impulse. Who are you, that you can stand this close to the thing I can barely look at?
The answer turns out to be, they're business people, caregivers, ritual chameleons, people who learned a set of skills for managing what most of us never learned to manage. Not because they're fundamentally different from the rest of us, but because they were trained, or they grew up in it, or they found their way into it and discovered they could do the work.
If you take one thing from this, I think it's that the comfort funeral directors have with death isn't a personality trait. It's a professional scaffold. It's built, not born. And the same scaffold that lets them do the work can make it harder for them to grieve their own losses.
The other piece that stays with me is that the dead are the easy part. The living are the work. Every funeral director we read about, every interview, every study, it all comes back to the families. The emotional labor of compassion, day after day, is what wears people down, not the bodies.
Which leaves an open question. If the profession attracts people who are good at compartmentalizing, and then trains them to get even better at it, what happens when the compartment breaks? When it's their own father, their own spouse, their own child, the data on delayed grief suggests it's a real problem, and one the profession doesn't talk about enough.
It's the paradox at the center of the whole thing. The skills that make you good at this work are the same skills that make you bad at your own grief.
We've been talking about funeral directors, but I think the episode is really about all of us. The way we outsource death to professionals and then wonder about them as if they're a different species. They're not. They're just the ones who said yes to the work.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping us on track, and for the story about Mortimer. I suspect there are a lot of Mortimers out there, in small towns all over the country, doing the work quietly and keeping a bottle in the prep room for whoever needs it.
This has been my weird prompts. If you've got a weird prompt, something you wondered at a funeral, a wedding, a DMV line, anywhere your mind wandered while you were supposed to be paying attention, send it to show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll dig into it.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep